Hi, Niall. How's it going?
Not too bad, Ricky. Great to be talking to you again, and great to be kicking off a new season of In Your Nature. I've been dying for this. Really looking forward to it.
Spring 2022, and we're getting stuck into our first episode back.
Absolutely. So the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage.
Thanks to them for making it possible. And today sort of eases in nicely to a subject we both love and a group of birds we both love. We're going to talk about the crows.
Yeah, absolutely. The crows, the corvid family. I think I've been looking forward to this podcast episode more than any of our other ones. Great, though, those all have been, because there's just something about crows. I know they get a lot of bad press. I know that a lot of people have negative things to say about them, certainly in Birdwatcher, and they contact us all the time complaining about them. But the fact is, they are astonishing creatures. They're just the superlative birds in many ways.
Yeah, no, they're absolutely amazing. And as a family, worldwide, they're pretty cool. I mean, lots and lots of species. And in Ireland alone, of the corvids, the crow family, we have 7 species. So some people will be shocked to hear that. And of those, trying to keep it in order of size, starting with the biggest, we've got raven. Mm-hmm. We then have the hooded crow. We then have the rook, the chough, the jackdaw.
Yeah.
The magpie then, when we're...
Yeah, I guess so. With that long tail kind of obscures things a bit, doesn't it? So the magpie. And then finally?
The jay.
Yeah, my favourite probably.
You've got sort of 5 of those species are what people would consider sort of, I suppose, true crows, the black crows, the corvids. And then we've got a species of magpie that everyone's familiar with too. And a jay, which is the most colourful of those birds. So, but they are all considered crows per se.
Yes, I suppose it begs the question, what exactly is a crow? Because we do think of crows as being these black-coloured birds, and many crows around the world are. You find them all across the planet. There are many different kinds of black crow. But there are also lots of very colourful crows too. So our jay, which is a pink and blue bird, essentially, it wouldn't look like a crow to in the normal understanding of it. But actually, if you go to the tropical regions of Central and South America particularly, also parts of Asia, some of the crow species there are incredibly colourful, big crests on their head and lots of iridescent plumage, you know. So not all crows are black by any means, but I suppose when we're talking about crow, when you say that word in Ireland, that what people are really thinking of is those black birds they see walking around the side of the road, and inevitably that's the rook. It's probably our most familiar member of the crow family, one of the most common and conspicuous birds in all of Ireland, I think.
Again, to give sort of, I suppose, an overview of the family, I would say that, firstly, another kind of thing that people will be shocked to hear is that they're songbirds. They're considered passerines.
They are, yeah, absolutely.
So that's amazing, and I mean, people will say they're caws and their squawks and their gurgles aren't very song-like, but as far as scientists and ornithologists are concerned, they are singing, perching birds, which sort of ticks both boxes to get them into the passerine group.
It does, absolutely, and it's worth pointing out that the raven is the largest songbird in the whole world, so that's a record that it holds, a big bird almost the size of a buzzard, or perhaps even bigger than a buzzard in some cases. And yes, it all comes down to the structure of the vocal apparatus of these birds, and from analysing that, they can squarely say these are indeed songbirds, the same as swallows and larks and warblers and all these other birds. And it seems that actually crows first evolved in what is today Australia. That's where they originated, and they're closely related to birds like orioles, the birds of paradise from New Guinea, shrikes as well, vireos. All of these birds are actually quite closely related. They came from similar origin in Australia. Seems they probably spread through there through what is today Antarctica, of all places, even though that's completely icebound today and there's no crows living there anymore. But they spread all over the world, and they've been a very successful species. And I think there's 2 reasons they're so successful. One is because they're highly adaptable. They can turn their beaks to anything. They can find food, they can find shelter wherever they need to. And the second reason is because they are so intelligent, almost freakily intelligent. And I'm sure we're going to be talking more about that through the course of this episode.
They're quite gregarious outside of the breeding season.
Yes, they are. They gather together in these social groups, and they really do have societies. In fact, the interactions between them are so complex that some people even would go so far as to say that certain crow species even have evolved a culture. There's so many parallels with humans. And we see that a lot in intelligent animals. In many cases, intelligence and gregariousness seem to go hand in hand. It seems to be important. If you look at us humans, for example, and our primate relatives, we often would live in groups or tribes or families as well. And intelligence seems to be very important for animals that have to cooperate with each other, that have to read each other's emotions, that have to try and pick up cues from each other and solve problems together as a group. And that seems to be how it happened in corvids as well. So yeah, it's really fascinating how that intelligence it evolved completely independently from human or primate intelligence, and yet it's up there with many primates. That's smart.
Another thing that brings them all together, the seven species, is they're monogamous, and they largely pair for life. In all relationships, there can be problems. They are, per se, monogamous, but there are exceptions to the rules. And there's some quite funny exceptions to the rules as well. And I might talk about some of those examples if you want to add anything first.
Well absolutely. So you're right, Ricky. They are, by and large, monogamous. There are, as you said, exceptions to that general rule. But the fact is, they spend a lot of time and effort and invested into those, forming those pair bonds. And you can often see crows together. They do a thing called allopreening. You'll see them, like, that means they're preening each other, like maybe scratching the back of each other's necks and helping to remove parasites. Exactly the same ways that we see chimpanzees and other apes and monkeys doing. It's all about strengthening this pair bond, showing that they're supporting each other. And crows invest far more time and effort into that than the vast majority of other birds. So it seems these bonds are very important to them. And it's only in certain circumstances where they might break and where there's infidelities happening. But they are far more faithful than the vast majority of our songbirds, absolutely.
The few examples I really love is that one is jackdaws, that male jackdaws, young male jackdaws especially, will quite happily break up from a pair, a mate, to increase their status among the flock. So if there's a sort of higher ranked female kicking around, maybe her partner has died or he has done sort of something similar, a young male will try to rank up by cozying up to the richer woman next door or whatever. So I think that's quite a clever way of doing things. I like how magpies do a thing called pair guarding or mate guarding. And that's often why we'll see two together, is that during, as breeding season approaches, the sort of would-be males in the local area will try get a sort of a, let's call it a quickie with the female of a pair, and the male, to stop that, will literally follow her inch from her tail, and if she jumps over the wall, he'll follow her. If she goes up the tree, he'll follow her, and you can see them following quite closely. And that's one of the reasons you often see that sort of one for sort of two for joy, that second bird always together, because he's literally following her on her foot, on her heels, to stop anyone sort of sneaking in, which I think is quite a good one too, a funny relationship thing. One I find really, really bizarre, and Derek Radcliffe referenced it a few times in his book, The Raven, which is sort of the Bible on the species, is a thing called rapid remating that ravens can do. And that's when a member of the pair is lost for whatever reason, and within literally hours, they can be replaced on the nest or rearing the chicks. So there was two examples Radcliffe gave. He gave one example where the female was lost on a nest. She had died, and the male had found a nice young female to bring back to the nest and start a new family. And she was actually attacking the original nestlings of the other female sort of hours later, so she could go ahead and start her own family with the male. So that's absolutely mad. And another example he gave where the female had been, or the male had been lost, and the female replaced the male within hours. By apparently he was shot that morning, and by 3 o'clock that afternoon there was a new male there serving her young. So that's just absolutely bananas. So it sounds like they've kind of got this substitute partner sort of somewhere in the ether. And the bizarre thing about that is breeding ravens have huge territories. So there's not even, they keep ravens out of their territory. It's not like they're sort of skulking nearby that you can give a whistle and say, hey, boy, come over here. The nest is empty, you know. So it's I don't know how it's done. I don't know. Do you know any more about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of mysteries there. We know that crows are very good at communicating, and there's obviously some way they can communicate these facts to each other and these concepts and plan ahead when they, so they almost have a degree of language as far as we can tell. A lot more research needs to be done, but it's, you know, I think a lot of the research has actually been biased by the fact that when we think of intelligence, we have a very human blueprint for what that is, whereas intelligence in other creatures can be very different. It doesn't mean they're any less intelligent, but certainly these bonds among crows are incredibly strong. I know a lot of work has been done in a species called the American crow. There's a researcher called Kevin McGowan who's in Cornell University in upstate New York. He's done decades of study on populations of American crows in that area, and he's found a lot about the familial relationships between them. This is really unusual in birds, or indeed in any wild animals, whereby you know, you'd have obviously the male and the female, the mum and the dad will look after chicks, but so will older siblings of those chicks from a previous brood, and so will uncles and aunts look after their nieces and nephews and help to feed them and provision for them. And that's really interesting, because in nature that's almost unique. It doesn't really happen in human beings. It happens and occasionally in some higher primate species, but that's more or less it. And then in crows, so I find that really remarkable that they know who each other are, they know who their relatives are, and they also have friends as well. We see unrelated crows will just pal around together. They'll seek each other out, they'll communicate with each other. And it gets to the it gets so complicated that it really is bordering on language. It seems crows, of certainly some species, can communicate complex ideas to each other vocally, which is absolutely mind-blowing.
Let's go back to our seven crow species again. Maybe let's give a brief description of them all, and we'll play the audio, I think, of each, because not everyone will be, you know, everyone will be familiar probably with rooks and jackdaws, and that might be it in many senses. So let's work our way up. So let's go with Jay, I suppose. Tell me a bit about Jays.
So the Jay, a very secretive bird, but a brightly coloured one. So it's the one that looks least like a typical crow. It's a mainly pink bird, paler on the head. It's got this astonishing flash of metallic blue on each wing, black tail. And often when they're flying away from you, you see this white lower back, this white rump patch that really sticks out in contrast with the tail. When they fly, they look, in terms of their structure, a bit like a magpie with a shorter tail. You can see when they fly, oh, that must be related to a magpie. But unlike magpies, they tend to be much shyer. They tend to hide away in the woodlands. They particularly love oak trees. So their favorite food of all would be acorns. And what they do is they gather lots of these, and they actually bury them for future use, to store them when other food becomes unavailable. And of course, in doing that, what they're doing is they're planting acorns and therefore oak trees all across their range, helping to provide more food for them for the future. But that's how oak trees became the dominant tree species across most of Europe and Asia, because the jays planted them there.
But yeah, it's really interesting that they're one, if not the only species that perpetuate their own habitat and food. They're basically farming their own future, which is absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I remember seeing some great analysis has been done on continental Europe in Germany, actually, about the role that goshawks, one of the main predators of jays, play in that. So they think that goshawks became essential in the propagation of oak forest as well, by killing some of those jays so they couldn't recover their acorns. And I think that this species is keystone there as well. So it's amazing how it's all linked together. And you mentioned about the sound of the birds there, Ricky, and I think if we play the sound of the jay, this is the best way to find them, because this harsh shrieking sound that they make, that's usually you'll hear that walking through a wood, and you realize, oh, there's a jay somewhere around here. And if you look, you might see one clambering around the tops of the trees, or maybe dashing out of cover and across into a new patch of trees. So this is the sound to listen for.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of hideous. Like, it's really kind of sinister sound. And I've said this before, the first jays I ever heard were in Garry Hinch Wood on the Leash-Offaly border. And before I knew better, I thought it was actually a bird of prey, because I thought that's what a big, scary bird of prey should sound like. And sounded a bit like sort of a little pig being sort of bludgeoned. It's really, really... really a bizarre call, but you won't mistake it once you kind of get that into your head. I know a nice way of watching jays is if you can find in autumn time where they're going between their cache spot, where they're caching their acorns from where they're foraging them, and you just see them maybe over a river or over a road, you can get some really good views of them just commuting over and back all day. It's really, really nice with sort of beak full of acorns or whatever. And it's amazing. They can, they don't quite stand up to Clark's nutcrackers and stuff in the States, but they can cache and find a majority of up to 5,000 acorns in a winter. They can find their acorns in up to 40 centimetres of snow. It's really quite something. And like you say, they forget a few of those, they grow, they become sort of acorn, or they become oak woodlands, and then the goshawks help them along there too, and you get whole woodlands or whatever. So that's really cool. So that's jays.
So just one of the most interesting things I found about jays, of course, is that it's one of the only birds where we have a unique Irish form of them. There's a unique Irish subspecies unique to this island, and it's one of only four birds that actually have that, because the jay has a huge range. They're found all the way from Ireland and Iberia in the west, right across to Japan and Taiwan in the east. This huge range, they have lots of variation in head pattern and eye color and all that, but our Irish birds are unique, so I think that's something to celebrate for sure.
Magpies, so the other outlier, I suppose, in the seven of the Irish corvids. Pika Pika, they're black and white, pied magpie mix, because they're pied color. They are super clever, super fun. Like, they've got a lot going on. They've got those sort of, you know, the one for sorrow, two for joy, three for girl, four for boy, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never to be told, all that sort of stuff. There's so much folklore and suspicion and everything around magpies, and they're largely disliked, probably because they're so kind of well, they're everywhere. They're seen as mischievous. There's a big thing about them being, people believe that they're introduced. Tell me about that. That's not the case.
It's not the case at all. No, that this is a widespread belief, and people often say it to us when they're complaining about magpies and giving out about them. That was associated actually with the arrival of Cromwell in Ireland too, giving them an additional kind of notoriety. But no, I mean, to be honest, when you look at a lot of historical bird records, or, you know, it's hard to judge exactly what was here and what wasn't, because it's only in the last couple of hundred years that people have really started documenting birds and other populations of wildlife in a meaningful way. It does seem that perhaps these birds were relatively unknown in Ireland until maybe the 1600s, when a group was seen flying in off the sea in County Wexford, and pretty quickly they became widespread across Ireland there. But that, of course, doesn't mean that they're not native. That's how birds arrive in new areas. They colonize all the time. They fly. They came here under their own steam. And the fact is, of course, it's a common bird all across the continent, where they have evolved to coexist with all of our native wildlife that we have in Ireland. So they're very much a proper part of our ecosystems here in Ireland. They have a role to play. And yeah, it always upsets me a bit when we get so much hate towards them. I mean, certainly people contact Birdwatch Ireland constantly complaining about magpies and saying they should all be shot and they cause so much damage. And part of it is, I really think that people sometimes resent their success, because one thing we often hear is they say that there's loads of magpies in my area, there are no small birds left anymore, and the magpies therefore must have killed all the small birds. And that's not what's happened at all. There's no denying that magpies, as part of their diet, they do prey on chicks in nests, they do prey on eggs, absolutely do that. So do many creatures, including squirrels and rats and all sorts of creatures do that too. But the fact of it is that they eat lots of other things too. They control many of the predators that would rob those nests as well. And the thing is that the real culprit here in the declines of lots of bird species, it's us humans and our changes to the environment. It's habitat destruction, intensification of agriculture. And the fact is, the magpie can weather those changes much better than the other birds can. So they're surviving and thriving despite our best efforts to destroy their habitat in a way that the other birds can't. And that's down to the magpie's intelligence, resourcefulness and adaptability. The other birds just can't match them in that. So we humans should really take most of the blame there, not the magpies at all.
Yeah, no, I think they're fabulous. I think actually they are probably one of the most handsome birds we have as well.
Yeah.
If you see a magpie after it's molted and it's in full good plumage, breeding plumage, and it catches the sun, that azure blue and that petrol kind of sheen off them, they are just the most frighteningly beautiful bird ever. And they're slim and they're upright and they're quite a proud looking thing. And a nice clean build. They're just, I don't know, I find them just really, really, really handsome birds. And yeah, they brown people off and people come up with gizmos to get them off their feeders. And I can understand all that. And they seem like bullies and they do okay on their own anyway. And people probably don't realise as well that they nest in loose colonies as well. So like if you look around, the best time I always find to notice it is in a housing estate or maybe like a large car park or a hotel complex or something like that in the autumn and winter when the leaves come off the tree and you can see those dome magpie nests. If you have a quick sort of scan around, sort of every couple of 100 metres there'll be a magpie nest in a tree or a bush. And they do nest in loose colonies. People think they nest alone, but they're similar to other crows in that they do like to be close to each other, but not overly close. But they're super birds. A really fascinating story that came out a few weeks ago from Australia on the Australian magpie was this thing where the scientists were putting on the trackers and they were fixing them using these very, very high tech backpacks is what they call them now. Back in the day, they used to glue them on and do all sorts of unethical things. But they used this very, very complex magnet driven backpack system to connect these GPS trackers to these magpies after they had spent weeks and weeks luring and gaining the trust of this group of magpies before they caught them, because they wanted to study their movements and their sociality and all that sort of stuff. Within a few minutes of getting these backpacks on the magpies, they already noticed birds without them and they had removed them. And when they start looking around, they notice birds without the ones that had already got them removed, helping the other birds to get them off. And within 4 or 5 days, the 10 birds that they had tagged had got them all off. And these are literally the wittiest scientists with the best equipment in all the world. And the magpies had them outwitted within a few minutes. So it's they're just super clever.
It really boils down to this avian intelligence, the ability to solve new problems, things they've never encountered before, but also the ability to learn from each other. And I think that we even see this in our own gardens with our own Eurasian magpies. If you see a magpie in your garden, stop and just watch it for a few minutes and see what it does. You'll see that there's someone inside that head. They're thinking, they're planning ahead, they're cunning, they're really clever, they're astonishing to watch. And I think one of the things that really blew my mind about them was there's some research done a few years ago in sort of like sentience in birds and self-recognition, and they found that the magpie is one of very few animals in the world that can look at a reflection of itself and realize it's looking at itself. So and people wonder, how could you do that? Well, it's actually quite simple. It's an ingenious experiment. What they did was they got magpies and many other birds and other animals as well, and when they're asleep or when they're maybe under an anesthetic, so they're not conscious, they'd put a little red spot, a spot of paint or a sticker, maybe on the forehead of the bird or someplace it couldn't see it with its own eyes in a normal sort of course of events, and then they would put it in front of a mirror, and if the bird saw the red spot and then tried to scratch it off or tried to remove it, they'd know, it sees its reflection and knows it's looking at itself. Virtually all animals fail that test. Some of the primates will, so the apes can do it. I think elephants can do it as well, but for example dogs and cats completely fail it. If you're a dog or a cat, if they're looking at their reflection, they think they're seeing another dog or cat, but the magpie knows it's seeing itself, which is absolutely amazing.
And we fall over ourselves writing books about how intelligent dogs are, and don't get me wrong, I love dogs and kept them all my life and they are super intelligent, but they cannot solve those novel problems like a novel problem is something that is presented to you for the first time ever that you've not got to study for, and you've got to figure that out there and then in that space, and you're not being trained to do that, you know. So the magpies are certainly something to behold. Let's go jackdaw.
Yes,
they're just fab, familiar to people, small blue-eyed boys. They're just really, really, really nice. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so the jackdaw, so the name tells you what it is. It's from the Old English. Jack meant small or diminutive, and daw was the name for crow. So jackdaw, small crow. And it is the smallest of the common, conspicuous, mostly dark-coloured crows that you'd see. Although it's not jet black, unlike the rook, for example. No. You will see when you look up close, they have this lovely sort of silvery wash on the back of the neck, sort of forms almost like a half collar around the sides of that. And if you look very close, they're actually really, really dark, sooty grey rather than pure black on parts of the body as well. But the thing I like most about them is their eyes. They have pale eyes, but that's quite unusual for a crow in itself. They look white from a distance, but up close you actually see that this gorgeous pale sky blue. So they're the blue-eyed crow, and you always find them in groups. They form these social colonies. They often will collaborate and live alongside rooks. You'll see the two of them together, and if you do, the jackdaw is the smaller of the two. But this is a bird that everyone in Ireland knows. You'll see them, if you look out your window or you're driving on the road, it'll only be a few minutes at most before a jackdaw flies past. You see them all the time. They're always walking around in a sort of very stately way, very deliberately looking through grass to try and find invertebrates that they can feed on. But like the other crow species, they're incredibly adaptable. So if they find any source of food arises, like if someone left the lid off their bin, for example, or there's roadkill there or anything like that, they'll be on it straight away, and they'll pretty quickly work out that this is something they can eat. But I think the thing I like about them as well is that they kind of have the measure of us humans. You can get quite close to them. If you don't behave in a threatening way, they know that humans are all right. They know that they can sort of trust us to a degree. But if you start to look at them too intently, they get suspicious. They sort of edge away from you, and if you move towards them, they'll fly off. They really are judging us all the time and seeing. But also what's really cool is they keep watch out for each other within the flock. They'll have a sentry who's giving warnings about someone's behavior or a human getting too close, or especially if they find something like a cat coming nearby, they give these special calls. They're able to tell each other where the predator is coming from. It's coming from the sky, coming from the ground. They have different calls for all of these, as do magpies, and I just find that really amazing.
When you mentioned calls there, and before I forget, because I didn't slip it in there for magpies, but I'll make sure we go back and do that. Let's listen to some of the jackdaw calls. I find it quite electronic. I think it's cool. Let's hear it.
That brings me back. It's such a great sound, and I love particularly, especially on winter evenings when you have a big rooster crows coming together. If you hear the jackdaws in there, you hear that chacking sound that they make. It's very distinctive, and that's a good way to identify them, pick them up, and learn what crows are in a flock. If you hear that sound, you know there's jackdaws in there for sure.
They're deadly. They're the guys you're going to find in your chimney, sort of come, you know, autumn when you want to light the fire for the first time, and then you realise the sitting room smoked out and that they've have been occupying the chimney all summer with a huge ball of sticks you then have to sort of get out or whatever. So I got a couple of phone calls from friends and family this week wondering what they're going to do with the jackdaws in the chimney, and so they've already started building. So watch out, everyone. You've got to get a bird cowl up on the chimney ASAP. Stop them doing that. And yeah, they like runes. They like sort of cracks and crevices, and you often find them in chimneys and old castles and cottages and sheds, and but always with massive bits of lumps of sticks everywhere, so they'd be quite messy. They are nice to have around the place.
They're also the crow that is most likely to steal shiny objects. The magpies often get blamed for that, but actually jackdaws do it more than magpies do. Now, it's still quite rare that it happens, but it all comes down to intelligence, and therefore when you have intelligence, you're inquisitive, and you can also become easily bored. And it seems that they are fascinated by novel objects. If they find something that they've never seen before, something that has a lovely shine off it or a bright colour, they think, oh, this is pretty unique. This is going to make me stand out to all of my friends and family. They're going to think I'm something pretty special if I've got this treasure. And it seems that's why they gather these, as far as we can tell. We can't get into their heads, but there's certainly some reason, because they're not using them for any kind of food. They're not using them for any kind of defense. It's just purely because they seem to like these objects in their own rights. So that's one of the traits of the jackdaw that I suppose it's a bit annoying, but I really admire it, I have to say.
So that's jackdaw. Amazing. This is probably the rarest, the chough. People won't, unless you spend a lot of time on the coast and you're a bit tuned in, there's a good chance you've just either written them off as jackdaws or not noticed them at all, really, depending on what part of the country you visit or you're from. So tell me about the Cag Cus Jarrig.
Yes, the red-legged jackdaw, indeed. It's a very good description of it. So the chough, it's very similar in size and sort of in shape to a jackdaw, but it's jet glossy black. It has sort of longer wings with these sort of fingered wingtips, almost a bit like a bird of prey, the way that the wingtips are like that. But the most striking feature about it, in addition to its bright red legs, it has this bright red, long, down-curving beak, which means that if you see it, you're not going to mistake it for any other bird. There's no other bird in Ireland that looks like that. But you're right, it's one that you kind of have to make a special effort to go and see, because it's not one that is going to turn up in a suburban garden, or indeed it's absent from most of the country. You really have to be in certain areas like coast and coastal headlands, particularly around parts of the south coast of Ireland and the west coast. They used to be present all around the Irish coast, but on the east coast they're completely extinct, and even in on the Ulster coast they're few and far between. There is a small number of them on Rathlin Island, but they're mostly absent from Northern Ireland. But if you go from sort of Donegal southwards along that coast and then sort of round to Waterford, if you're following that coastline, that's where you find them. But even there they're quite localised, but you will see them always close to the sea here, and that seems to be a pattern this species follows in this part of northwestern Europe. We sometimes call this bird the Celtic crow, because in this part of Europe it's confined to the sort of the west and south coasts of Ireland. It's also found in western Scotland, parts of Wales, especially along the coast, the Isle of Man, in Cornwall. It's making a bit of a resurgence there. It's actually the national bird of Cornwall, and also in Brittany. And that's pretty much it. They're not widespread elsewhere in that part of Europe. But then if you go further south, if you go to Iberia, it's a relatively numerous bird, but well inland in the mountains close to Madrid, for example, you find them. Also on the Canary Islands. They're absent from most of the Canary Islands, except for the island of La Palma, where they're actually a common bird and you find them in flocks of hundreds. And then they spread across North Africa and through into the Himalayas, and then they become these high mountain birds rather than coastal birds. So that tells me about them. There's something about the chough that means they're adapted to marginal, difficult habitats, where they can outcompete the other crows. They can't compete with the rooks and the jackdaws in normal, general habitats. They're more specialised than that.
Yeah, and we do have small populations kind of up mountains, not a million miles from the coast in different parts of the country, but it's certainly the coastal guys are more common. I find them very kite-like. It's like they're being blown around in the wind all the time. They barely need to sort of fly or make any effort themselves. They've totally adapted to just those harsh conditions. And it'll sort of give another example of this when we talk about rooks in a bit. But I've read about them, how they'll nest in old cliff crags and old ruins and stuff like that. Kind of similar to where jackdaws would, but also in cliffs. And but when they're roosting in the winter, the more dominant birds will actually force younger, less dominant, subordinate birds out to the edge of the crags, where they're more exposed to the weather and they can protect them from the weather a bit more. But also they're less protected from the likes of a wandering peregrine might be tipping past, and your sort of younger cousin's going to get nabbed rather than you on the inside of the cliff. So I think that's it's quite sinister, but it's a good survival mechanism as well. So there is rank. There is a social rank is a big thing among crows. It's certainly apparent.
Oh, it is, absolutely. And you can see that any crow species, if you just watch them for any extended period of time, you'll start to see these interactions between them. You'll see how some will boss others around, some are subservient to others, and they cower away from them, those kind of things. One of the things I also love about choughs as well is when they're flying, you mentioned how good they are there flying. Sometimes it's quite clear to me that they're just doing it for the fun of it. You'll see them sometimes doing like loop the loops in the air, or even see them sometimes flipping upside down and flying in heavy winds. And there's no reason for them to do that other than just for the sheer joy of it, because they're not finding food, they're not escaping a predator, they're practicing and honing their skills, and that's what a lot of play is about. But they really are supreme flyers, and those sort of long fingered wingtips that they have would suggest that they're very agile in the air. So that's something that I really love about them. But probably the thing I like most about them are the sounds that they make, because the chough is it's a strange name for a bird, but it's named after one of its main calls, and the sounds that choughs make are just magical. So maybe we could just play the sound of some choughs there, and just see people hear them for themselves. What a sound that is, Ricky. That's just magic. When I hear that, I'm transported to a coastal headland, and I hear that sound, I'm spinning around. Where are they? I want to see them. That's chuffs all over.
Absolutely savage. Cool. That brings us to my favourite, possibly the most numerous bird in Ireland, certainly the most ubiquitous. It's the rook. They're whoppers. They're a proper bird. Probably most commonly known to be hanging upside down over some silage bales at your local farm, where the local farmer has hoped a couple of dead ones will deter his buddies sort of feeding on calf meal and his silage and bits and bobs. But they're the guys you see sometimes in the car park at McDonald's, big black grey legs. They've got these kind of shaggy trousers, and they've got the big grey bill and a bit of a bear patch. The adults have a big bear patch at the base as well. Maybe the ugliest of the crows, is that fair to say?
I think by our human aesthetic, yes. Yeah, they certainly look kind of brutish, certainly. And that bear patch of skin on their face, that does give them a sort of harsher look than our other crows. Of course, that's an adaptation so that they can bury their faces into animal carcasses without staining their feathers, the same way that vultures tend to have bald heads. So and also so they can dig in the ground and they have a bit, you know, the soil isn't fouling up their feathers, because they probe a lot in the ground to get leather jackets and invertebrates like that. But I do love watching them, because they're really interesting birds, like all the crows. You see them sort of strutting around the place. I suppose in Ireland it really is our default crow. If you say the word crow to anybody, particularly to a non-bird watcher, the bird that immediately pops into their mind is the rook. This is the black coloured crow we see all over the place. Ireland has a particularly high population density of these birds. Like, they're really numerous, and I was actually astonished recently to see that actually at a European level this bird is now on the red list, meaning that it's actually under severe threat in much of Europe. So the population we have in Ireland is actually really now of international importance, because certainly they're not under threat here. They're extremely common. So it obviously there's something about the Irish conditions that favour them. One of the reasons for that actually could be that the relative scarcity of birds of prey that we have here, because buzzards and rooks are direct competitors when it comes to things like roadkill and scavenging for any kind of meat that they might find in the countryside. And with the decline in our buzzard populations historically, we've seen a big increase in scavenging creatures like rooks, and also creatures like foxes too, that rush in to fill that vacuum. So that might be one of the reasons why they're so abundant here. But certainly it's a bird that I'm sure everyone listening to us here now, at least if they live in Ireland, they know this bird well.
And what we probably failed to mention as well is that rooks and crows, and with the exception of jays, are an animal of the open country. So when we start sort of chopping down the forests in Ireland hundreds of years ago, they would have adapted quite well. They like the open ground, they like pastoral grassland, they like grazing animals. So our farming system suits them quite well. So for them to forage for leather jackets, which is the larvae of the daddy long leg, should we say, they find that in abundance in our open fields and our well fertilized fields around the country. So we make things easy for them in many ways here.
Oh yes, this is certainly a species that has benefited greatly from human activities in the way that we've changed the landscape. If you look at what Ireland would have been like before humans felled so much of our woodlands and conducted agriculture, it wouldn't have been a great place for rooks really at all. They would have been able to hang on in some of the coastal plains, maybe some of the midlands perhaps, but areas that were like pure like dense woodland or pure bogland with nowhere to perch, that's not habitat that a rook would be happy with at all. So we humans in altering the landscape have really benefited that bird greatly. So yeah, we're a big reason for their success.
They do need some trees because they roost and they nest obviously in trees, and they can form huge rookeries, and that's what gives them name to the rook. Where rooks nest is a rookery, and where they roost is just a roost, but they can be the same locations if you like. But I know from my own studies that a rookery where the nests are found are not ever as big as the actual roost site. So I have a site in Port Leash, the Downs Rookery, where I sort of census each year. And a number of years ago, on average, there was 400 nests. Or 200 nests in total that summer, which is 400 birds. And that winter, there was 4,000 birds. Yeah. So you're looking at only 10% of the birds. So there's wherever the rest of those are coming from, they're coming from other rookeries around the county. So they're quite amazing. But the structure of a rook roost in the winter is just fascinating to watch them sort of come together in the evenings. And it's not quite the spectacle of a starling murmuration, but the numbers you get there, when you get 4,000 rooks together with maybe 1,000 jackdaws all swirling around, reorganising, getting organised before they sort of go down for the night in the trees, it's quite a sort of visual and audio spectacle. It's really, really amazing. And I've seen some fab things. But what I've learned is from it, again, that social hierarchy comes into what happens at the roost. So the young birds are expected to take the branches down below on the lower limbs of the trees, whilst the sort of higher ranking birds, a couple of years older, and then the adult birds are sort of going further up and at the top. And the reason this happens is because information filters upwards. So if you're some young teenage bird after sort of hanging out with your mates over in some fields over the parish, and you're after having a great time feeding all day, you're going to be chatting about it. And that information is filtering up to the guys above you. They're going, oh, is that true? Is that not? They're talking about it. And then that's going up to the most senior birds, and they're picking off the bits of information they think is important and the best stuff, and they're going away with that then. And meanwhile, then all the guano or the bird poo is raining down. So you don't want to be below them either. So the advantage of being at the top is twofold. You're getting all the information and you're getting none of the poo on your head, which is obviously an advantage. And what I have seen in extreme weather is it actually swaps, is that the older birds will force the young birds on top to act as sort of biological or human umbrellas, or crow umbrellas, should we say, if the weather is really severe and wet. So the rank is really, really comes back into things all the time with crows.
Yeah, it's absolutely astonishing. And the more we look into this, the more we're learning about how their hierarchies. You mentioned the audio aspect of these roosts as well. The amount of noise they make, especially just before they go to sleep, is absolutely incredible. And they're obviously conveying information. There's no other reason for them to do that. They are able to pick up on each other's cues. As I said earlier, there is some degree of what we would term language that's going on there. We just can't speak that language. You don't know what they're saying. But again, you can see the supreme intelligence of these birds. And that's actually reflected in some experiments that have been done recently in relation to tool use in rooks and what they can do. So in the wild, rooks aren't observed using tools. There are some species of crow in the world that happily use tools and use them a lot. They're probably the least leader in that is a bird called the New Caledonian Crow from the island of New Caledonia. And it actually gets pieces of wood and fashions them into hooks to extract insect larvae from trees. They actually will combine pieces of wood together to make a composite tool. They'll actually hide them from their rivals as well. They'll hide their favourite tools in certain areas. So I was wondering if other crows can do this. And they found that rooks in captivity, if they were given food that had to be reached with some sort of a hook, and they were given a piece of wire, like a long straight piece of wire, they would, just without anyone showing them how to do this, they would bend the end of that wire into a hook, which they then use to hook up the food parcel and take it out, and they could eat them that way. And that's absolute genius. And another experiment that was done was putting some food floating in sort of a tube, a bit like a wider test tube or some sort of scientific apparatus, floating on top of the water, but out of reach of the beak of the rook. It couldn't reach down, so it's floating in the water there. And they put some small stones and pebbles around too. And again, without anyone showing the rooks what to do, they will pick up those pebbles, put them into the water to raise the water level until the food is close enough to the beak that they can grab it. And not only that, they'll use the biggest pebbles first because it's the minimum effort. They know that'll raise the water the most. Now, Ricky, I know some humans that couldn't work that out, so that's pretty smart.
That's gas. The hooded crow. These guys are whoppers. You're getting into big crows now, and density is less. You don't see them as much. They're very widespread, but in, I suppose, lower numbers. They're a big crow. They're the big sort of black and grey guys. Powerful crow, intelligent crow. They sort of occupy a niche somewhere between the rooks and somewhere between the ravens. They're not fully committed to either, I think. Sort of, they don't compete directly with either.
Yes, a really beautiful bird if you see them up close. That pattern of the black and the grey that they have, it's very distinctive. And some parts of Ireland, they're called the grey crow because of that reason, or sometimes the scald crow is another name that you hear for them. And for some reason, although they're a very common bird, they are less gregarious than rooks and jackdaws. They will gather together in numbers and they will have communal roosts, but you tend not to see huge flocks of them out feeding. You see ones and twos or maybe loose groups together, possibly family units as far as we can tell. But also, you'll see that they're more wary of human beings as well. They will tend to be a bit more suspicious of our activity. So if you see some together, maybe with jackdaws and rooks, that would often be the case. Those three species might be found together. If a human walks close by, the jackdaws and the rooks will sort of tolerate you and maybe just sort of keep a close eye on you. The hooded crows are the ones that will actually take flight first, or they'll walk away faster or hop up into a tree just because they feel a little less secure. So they are more suspicious of us humans and our motivations. And of course, I'm not surprised, because this is a bird that is quite widely persecuted in Ireland. Quite a lot of our hooded crows end up being shot by farmers and landowners. And it's a bird that people, I suppose, are suspicious of in some ways, because they are seen as scavengers, which is a good thing, really, because if it wasn't for scavengers, our countryside would be full of roadkill and dead meat and all these things that would spread disease. So they form a vital service, perform a vital service. But the fact of it is, yeah, a lot of people are quite suspicious of them or don't really like them. But I personally do. I think they're fantastic.
You get a lot of them on the East Coast as well. I mean, there's we often have arguments. We do a lot of water bird counts around Dublin for work. And we only focus on the water birds. But because we see so many hooded crows out on the estuary in the intertidal zone feeding on shellfish and the other invertebrates that can get out there, we've considered a few times adding them to our list, because they're obviously an important component of that ecosystem.
Yes, you'll see often in coastal areas, you'll see hooded crows particularly picking up shellfish, flying up to a height and dropping them onto the rocks to break them open. And this is quite characteristic. And what they'll do is when they drop it, they sort of swoop down so no other crow will fly in and snatch it. And again, that's really interesting to see it, see them do that. They've obviously learned from watching each other as well that this is a behavior they can do. We know that they pass this technique onto their offspring, and they pass the, they communicate this, these tricks of the trade, I suppose, to each other in that way. One of the things we see with hooded crows and with other birds or other members of the crow family as well is that they often, people report them to us, they say that they see a crow in their area that has perhaps a deformed beak. There's something wrong with the bird's beak. For example, there's a rook that lives near me here in North Wicklow. I've seen it for the last 8 years, at least on a weekly basis. And its beak, it looks really deformed. It's got this really crooked beak, and the top mandible is looping over the bottom one. It's sort of crossed and hooked. And I've seen hooded crows with that as well. And the fact is that, you know, this can happen to any bird. It can be caused by an infection or maybe by the jaws going out of alignment because of an injury. But the fact is, we see the crows that have this surviving, whereas the other birds that have this would die because they can't feed. But crows are able to actually to overcome this handicap or this disability and still find food regardless. And that just shows, again, how resourceful they are. So I think if people look more closely at rooks and at hooded crows particularly, they'll start to notice these things about them, that they're actually able to cope with the handicap in life that isn't fatal in the way it would be for other birds. And again, it all comes down to the intelligence and the resourcefulness.
Let's have a listen to them.
Quite a gruff sound, isn't it? You know that's you know, you certainly wouldn't call that sound beautiful. It's in some ways even slightly intimidating, but it's classic, and that's a common sound in the Irish countryside.
Very guttural and throaty, getting towards the raven. The another thing shows their intelligence as well is a few years ago I was just getting different examples for a talk I was doing about crows, and I wanted to show how birds who have fun or can have fun and for no other reason, or do stuff just for no other reason other than just have fun. And I found this great video from Russia of these birds using pieces of plastic lids off like just tins of food or whatever to snowboard down the roof, snow-covered roofs. And the point I was making was that if you've got your life so sorted out as a wild animal that you can pause to actually have fun, if you can take your eye off like potentially predators getting you, if you've enough food in your belly, if you've got your sort of chicks all fed and sorted and you've got time to go have fun, that shows an awful lot of intelligence that you've got your life sorted out. And it's so rare, like most animals spend their life just on the back foot, just trying to survive. So it really does show that they're just super adaptable and just they just got themselves sort of sorted. So if people just Google snowboarding crows, they'll find it there on the internet. It's quite good. The last but not least, the pièce de résistance, the raven, an absolute whopper of an animal. So much good things to say about these animals. They're just... They're fabulous.
Oh, they are. As I said earlier, they're officially the largest songbird in the world, and they are enormous. And if you get up close to one, which is rare because they're very wary of humans, although it's a pretty common and widespread bird in Ireland, most of them tend to be mainly in upland areas or remote areas away from humans. Although having said that, we are, particularly on the East Coast, starting to see them moving more into suburban areas. Occasional birds do strange things. So, for example, where I live in North County Wicklow, there's been a pair of ravens sort of hanging around on the lampposts around my estate occasionally. See them calling from up there. And it's only when you see them even against the other crows, when you look at a hooded crow or a rook, you think that's a big bird. You see a raven beside them and you realize no, the raven's way larger. They are massive, and when they fly they really give an impression almost like a bird of prey. They have this huge strong beak, they have this sort of shaggy throat, which you can, if you see them on the ground, you have this sort of, it almost look like a beard dangling down to a degree. But probably the most distinctive thing about them, when they fly, they have a very unusually shaped tail. It's shaped almost like a wedge or a diamond. It's quite unlike the shape of other birds' tails. And that's a good way to identify them. Even at a long distance, when you can't judge the size, the shape is very distinctive.
Let's listen to them, because they have a really guttural tone and call that carries. It's so low. It carries like across valleys. Like it's amazing. And they also are great mimics, so they can do loads of different sounds as well. But let's have a quick listen.
There's no mistaking that. Just the depth of it, like the power of it. That's that. There's no other bird in Ireland sounds like that. It's amazing.
Tons of examples of intelligence and studies with ravens as well. They were kind of with all science and all sort of behavioural science, things become trendy and certain subjects become trendy. And you know, but there's a guy called Brent Hindrick on the East Coast in the US, and he's been working on captive and wild ravens for some time, and he proved with some very sort of simple studies that they do communicate to each other, they do pass on information. And one simple study I really liked was that he went to a raven roost where they gather together in the winter in the trees. He'd climb the trees when they're asleep, he'd nab a few, he'd take them from the roost, he'd bring them home to his own aviary, he'd leave them there sort of where they hadn't seen where they'd been, they don't know where they are, for weeks and weeks. Then he'd go out with a carcass, a dead moose carcass, and he'd show the handful of ravens where it is, this dead carcass. He'd cover it in snow so no other ravens could find it or identify it in time, and then he'd release the ravens back at their original roost. Within, by the next morning, the ravens that he had, the captive ones, he'd have tagged them so he'd know they were there, would have arrived back with a couple of hundred of their buddies to feast on this moose. So the first thing they did the next morning when all their buddies woke up, said, hey, this guy, you never guess what he did, he's left us a moose out in the woods here and I'm going to bring you all to it. So they do talk and they do share information, and that's, again, can't use the word enough, it's intelligence. And what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And in the winter, because food becomes harder to get, and you're not competing to sort of feed your own chicks, you can be more gregarious and you can share that information, because the day that you have no food, you're hoping your buddy in the roost next door to you is going to lead you to the next moose. So that's what they're up to. That's their adaptation to that.
I think that this intelligence that ravens have and this communicative ability that they have, it's something that many cultures across the world have noted, because ravens, the same species we have here, they're found all across parts of Europe, Asia and North America, the same species. And there's lots of myths and legends and stories about them. So they feature quite prominently in Irish mythology. They feature very strongly in Norse mythology. They were the messengers, yes, of Odin, who would report back on the activities of humans to the gods. There are many Native American cultures where the raven is a sacred bird, or again a messenger from the heavens. So this idea that ravens are watching and learning and communicating is something that we see across all sorts of human cultures. So it's something, a bird that's made a strong impression on people.
Yeah, and the ravens in the Bible, it's in the Quran, loads and loads of stories, and people have looked to ravens for signs for millennia, really.
There's a connection between humans and ravens, you might even say, on a spiritual level, if I'm not getting too carried away with myself there. They do make an impression on us. I think we make an impression on them too. We kind of have to measure each other a bit.
We didn't do a bird of the week. We sort of integrated it there, but I'm going to nominate Rook as our bird of the week. So get out there and make sure you spot your local rooks and see what they're up to. At this time of year, they're now starting to build nests in the rookery. The huge winter roosts will be starting to disband a little bit, so they won't be quite the size they have been for the last couple of months, but still worth getting a look in there. And you'll see them just carrying sticks from all directions and getting together and getting a bit louder during the day and spending more time in those trees. So they're quite early nesters as it goes. So hopefully you'll see plenty of rooks and other crows over the next few months.
Yes, they do deserve more respect, and you know, I wish people would maybe look at them with fresh eyes. You know, I know that sometimes people can find them annoying, or they might not like some of their habits, but I'm sure they don't like our habits either, and we humans are far worse when it comes to our behavior. I think if people take one thing from this podcast, the next time you see any corvid, any member of the crow family, as I said, just watch it for a few minutes, see how it behaves, see what it does, see how it reacts to other members of its flock and even to you and its environment, and you'll see that, wow, there's something supremely intelligent in there. I think that's really great. So hopefully people coming out of this will have a newfound respect for crows. Just to say as well, you know, that when it comes to birds and that we in Birdwatch Ireland, we need your help to support them and to protect them and to conserve them, because we're a charity. We rely completely on our members to support us in the work that we do. So if you're interested in helping Ireland's birds and helping us in that work, please do become a member of Birdwatch Ireland. You'll find full details at birdwatchireland.ie. You'll get our magazine Wings that comes out throughout the year, our kids magazine Bird Detectives for our family and junior members, a set of posters when you join, a lovely welcome pack. You get to go to hundreds and hundreds of branch events all over the country where we're watching crows and many other species as well. So birdwatchireland.ie, we'd really appreciate your support. Just to say as well, to remind everyone, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage.
Thanks, Niall. Thanks, everyone. Delighted to be back. Talk to you next time.